Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. My name is Nicole, and I will be your host for our weekly Global Awaken Call. We are so thankful for you joining us today. The purpose of these calls is really to share stories and to tell stories, stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us through their actions to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers whose invisible work allows us to hold this space every single week. Today, I'm really excited to have our guest speaker be none other than Mary Gentile. Did I say it correctly?
Very good.
She said thank the you. Italian way. Yeah, like, oh, gosh, I could say it in Italian. And she really embodies our theme of voicing our values. And I'm really excited for this theme today. Our call will work like this. In a few moments, I'm going to introduce our moderator, REA Cooper Smith, and he will engage in a deep dialogue with our speaker, Mary. And by the top of the hour, we'll roll into Q&A and a circle of sharing. And at that point, we'll invite all of you to share your reflections and your questions. And we have our queue opened up right now. So at any point, you can hit *6 on your phone, and you'll be prompted when it's your turn to speak. And if you want to email us your questions, you can email us at ask@servicespace.org. And we'll remind you about that when it's time again. So this week's theme is one that I know I have been just really practicing for intensely for this past year, which is voicing our values. I recall a time actually about 2 weeks ago. I'm on a board of directors for a new cooperative organization, and I was invited to be on this board of directors to actually be the anchor for the values. And we were sitting in the weeds, looking at the budget and looking at all of the logistical just things that need to happen to turn it from a one-person visionary organization into a cooperative multiple-owner organization, and really have at the base of our values really is connection and people first and health first. And as we're sitting in this kind of budget-style meeting and lots talking about transactions, and we're talking about how people can buy in membership, I felt my whole body actually went away from what my whole purpose of being there was, which was to anchor us in our values and our decisions in our values. And I felt myself kind of just be like, okay, let's just go to transaction. Let's go to the easiest way to transact to bring in money so that we can cover our expenses. And I, luckily enough, was able to kind of notice that happened in me, and I slowed us down, and I actually asked if we could take a moment of silence so that I could actually gain my breath and gain my kind of compass inside. And in that moment, I realized we were straying from our values, and we were going to what was easiest. And so, In a conversation, I pushed us towards that, and we had some really actually valuable conversations that set an anchor for all of us. And in the past few weeks, we've been able to actually come up with an entirely new system that is not only anchored in our values, but is also easy, was exciting because we wanted both and we couldn't figure out how to get both because the way that we've been taught, all of us, many of us have been taught in a traditional model, this was kind of different than that. So that's my most recent experience with kind of what it was to practice voicing my values and that sort of thing in a business setting too. So I'm really excited for where the conversation's going to go today, and I'm also incredibly excited to bring in Arye to this conversation. And I know that Arye, you hold a lot of space for people to explore their values, and not only explore but practice voicing their values with One World Lights, and also with the more recent interfaith wisdom circles. And so I'd love to bring your voice in here and hear about any thoughts you have about our conversation today.
Well, that's very kind. Thank you, Nicole. It's good to hear your story. And, You know, I think you having your story, you know, illustrates, as I've been reflecting on this, how universal this issue is, that for all of us, we have times in our life where we have the choice about voicing our values, and Mary just focuses in on that and raises that level of consciousness so much. So I'd like to introduce Mary Gentile. She consults on management education and values-driven leadership. In her 10-year time at Harvard Business School, she developed and taught the school's first course on managing diversity. This is at Harvard Business School, and helped design and taught its first required module on ethical decision-making. Currently, she's director of Giving Voice to Values curriculum and senior research scholar at Babson College, and is also a senior advisor at the Aspen Institute Business and Society program. She is author of numerous books and articles, including her book, Giving Voice to Values, How to Speak Your Mind When You Know What's Right. While she was at Harvard Business School from 1985 to 95, she was one of the principal architects of their innovative educational program, Leadership, Ethics, and Corporate Responsibility. And she co-authored Can Ethics Be Taught? Perspectives, Challenges, and Approaches at Harvard Business School. And Giving Voice to Value, besides being a book, is also a program. It's a pioneering business curriculum for values-driven leadership. And it was launched by Aspen and by the Yale Institute of Management, and it's now based at Babson College. And they make it available for free to educators around the world. And it's being applied around the world in business, education, healthcare, not-for-profits, and probably a few other kinds of places that I haven't even included. So, Mary, thank you so much. It's really great to have you with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks, Arye.
Thank you. So I want to get right into a quote that's actually posted on the Awaken website as we start talking about what is this thing, giving voice to values. So you're quoted as saying, giving voice to values is not about persuading people to be more ethical. Rather, giving voice to values starts with the premise that most of us already want to act on our values, but that we also feel, we need to feel that we've got a reasonable chance of doing it effectively and successfully. So the curriculum focuses on implementation, on action, and asks the question, what if I were going to act on my values? What would I say and do? How could I be most effective? So that is really a very, for me, a very kind of dramatic way of framing what you're doing. And I want to ask you if you can just give us an overview of what is the Giving Voice to Values program.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And I just really want to say first that I'm very happy to be on this call, having taken a look at, you know, what happens in these webinars, and also having had a really lovely conversation with you, Arye, earlier this week, and hearing Nicole's story just now. I feel like this is the right group to be talking to. So giving voice to values, you know, as you said in your generous introduction, you know, I had been working at Harvard and then with other business schools around the world on these issues of how do we develop people's ethical awareness and ethical analysis and ethical capacity in business settings. And I was finding that the way that we typically approach these issues, whether it was in a school setting or in a corporate setting or, you know, other organizations, was to approach it entirely as if it were a cognitive question, as if it was entirely an intellectual question of understanding. That is, you know, we have to make sure people know what their values are. We have to make sure people know what the potential ethical infractions they might run into are. We have to make sure people know what the rules are, what the models of ethical reasoning are, that they've practiced sort of ethical analysis. And the assumption was that the problem was that people just don't know what's right. It's so complicated. And, you know, of course, there are times when it is, in fact, very complicated. But I also was seeing that many, many times when you looked at the kinds of scandals that would, you know, be in the papers around business transactions, they were often times when a lot of people, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people knew that something was kind of dodgy. But for whatever reason, they felt that they had no choice, they felt silenced, maybe they did try to speak and felt ignored or even retaliated against. And so I thought, gee, you know, we spend all our time doing this analysis and acting as if we need to persuade people to be ethical. We need to prove to them that ethics pays, quote unquote. And it seemed to me that I kept running into people who were uncomfortable with situations and just didn't think they had a choice. And so that was happening on the one side. And then on the other side, increasingly, I was reading research that was suggesting that if you really want to have an impact on people's behavior, that rehearsal, that practice was an effective way to do it. The scholars who are in the field of positive deviance, which is the field of psychology that looks at people who behave in a way that's deviant from the norm but in a positive direction, they have a nice way of phrasing it. They say that if you want to impact people's behavior, rather than asking them to think their way into a different way of acting, it's more effective to have them act their way into a different way of thinking. So there were these two strains going on for me. On the one hand, you know, I was recognizing that we were acting as if ethics was entirely an intellectual problem as opposed to a problem of confidence and competence. And on the other hand, I was realizing that if you want to develop skills and abilities and actual a tendency to actually act, that rehearsal was important. And so that was the origin of giving voice to values. I call it GVV. That was the origin of GVV, which was to bring those two things together.
You know, what's really struck me as I've been learning about this, Mary, is the power of the assumption you're making. You're assuming that people have values, that they have ethics, and that the issue isn't persuading people to be ethical or to have good values. The issue is showing them, giving them the skills, the pathway for how to actually manifest that.
That's right. That's right. You know, one of the things that I always use this kind of little mental model when I talk to people, and I say, you know, imagine that you're doing your job, you're working along, you've got your head down, and all of a sudden something happens. You either witness somebody behaving in a way that, you know, you think is problematic, or maybe your boss or a colleague comes and asks you or tells you to do something. Maybe a customer is trying to pressure you to do something. And you do get that feeling in your gut that this is off, that this is kind of dodgy. But before you can even think about how you might resist, all of what I call the preemptive rationalizations rush in. Things like, maybe I don't have all the information, maybe it's not really wrong, maybe it's really just the way things are done in this part of the world or this region or this industry or this company. Maybe it is wrong, but if I tried to do something, I'd just make it worse, or I would pay a high price, or it's not my responsibility. And, you know, all these, as I call them, preemptive rationalizations rush in. Many of them may be true. But the fact is they rush in before we even consider how we might act differently. And so what Giving Voice to Values is about sort of spreading out the time between the moment you get that feeling in your gut that something's off and the moment when all those preemptive rationalizations rush in to just kind of create a moment there. It's like the moment we took at the beginning of this call. You create a space, a laboratory, a safe space to practice, to ask ourselves what I call the Giving Voice to Values thought experiment question, which is not what would you do, but what if you wanted to act on your values. And we know from the research about creativity and innovation that people are more likely to be creative and innovative when they don't feel entirely pressured, when they do have more time. And so what, you know, if we create that space, now you're actually using all of the abilities you have, the things that got you to the position you're in your job anyways, your communication skills, your problem-solving skills, and you're actually using those to think about what could be some effective options here. We're transforming the emotional test of character into a simple problem-solving question. It still may be quite challenging, but it has a different emotional feel to it. We've normalized it. We've taken the stress out of it, and we are giving the opportunity for this rehearsal, which allows us to get more comfortable. And so, you know, I always say to people, look, you know, I can't make anybody do the right thing, but what I'm trying to do with Giving Voice to Values is help people understand they really do have a choice, because often people just feel like, I would have liked to act on my values. I didn't think I had a choice. People still have to make their own decision, but the idea here is rather than spending our time trying to convince you, we're going to spend our time trying to empower you. Because if someone doesn't believe it's possible, all of my efforts to convince them to be ethical are simply going to lead them to come up with more rationalizations about why it's impossible. So it's kind of like martial arts, you know, instead of going against the energy, you want to go with the energy. You want to appeal to the aspirational rather than the punitive.
Yeah. What an interesting approach. And you know, one of the things that strikes me in your book is you have something called A Tale of Two Stories, and mm-hmm. this approach where you invite people to tell two stories: one of a time in their life where there was an important decision and they chose to voice their values, and another time where there was an important decision to be made and they chose not to voice their values. And I'd be interested if you could share a little bit about this. Why is this such a powerful exercise? And what have you learned in the research of you know, hearing and reading people's answers to these two questions?
Yeah, it's really kind of been an interesting experience for me. It grew out of an exercise that I developed back in the day when I was still at Harvard, when I was designing their first course on managing diversity that you mentioned in your introduction. And I had an exercise there where I asked people to think about a time in their work experience when they were in a significant way in the majority. And then they had to answer certain questions about, you know, what their motivations were, how comfortably they felt with their teammates, what impact that had on their work, et cetera. And then I had them think about a time when they, in a significant way, they were in the minority. And then you ask the same questions. And it turned out to be such a powerful exercise because, you know, for some students, I remember when I taught the course at Harvard, you know, the majority of the students in the class at that time were white men. And some of them, the first thing they came up to me to say was, I've never been in the minority. Mm. And so, of course, that was their first learning. But then when you push them to think about, well, really, think about it, they would come up with examples. And I remember one guy talking about how, you know, he had been in a work group where he'd been the only, I think he was the only non-lawyer. And he had always been kind of a wunderkind, you know, somebody who performed really well and kept getting promoted rapidly. And then suddenly he felt like no one listened to him, that his ideas were not taken seriously, not valued. his performance suffered, his motivation suffered, and eventually he quit and went back to graduate school. And wow. For him, this was like a great big aha, because he began to realize that, you know, people's performance is not just a function of their skill or their intelligence or their motivation, that there is a kind of cultural and contextual reality that can impact people. And so that was such a powerful kind of exercise. And when I started developing Giving Voice to Values, I was trying to think about what would be the equivalent. And so we use the Tale of Two Stories because it does a couple things. Number one, it establishes right off the bat that this is not an exercise in defining your character, in sorting the good people from the bad people. Because when you do this exercise, you realize that all of us have at some point in our lives acted on our values effectively. We're all capable of that. And all of us have at other points in our lives failed to do so. And so right from the start, we're taking off the table the idea that this is about sorting moral character. And then we're shifting it over into action, into implementation, into problem solving, into skill building. And then the other thing that happens when we do this exercise is that we ask people to debrief it. They do a personal reflection, and then they debrief it in small groups and then in large groups. And we ask them not to share the negative story. We don't want to imprint on all of those, plus sometimes people feel more vulnerable. But we do ask them to share the positive story and then talk about what was different in the negative story. And when they do that, we end up generating a list of what we call enablers and disablers. The enablers are the things that made it easier for them to act effectively on their values when they did, and the disablers are the things that made it harder. And in the debrief, we find a couple things. When people start sharing the enablers and disablers, we realize that, you know, many of them are the same for everybody. So, for example, we all feel more able to enact our values when we have a boss who is open to discussion, who listens, right? We all feel less likely to act on our values when we're in an environment where any kind of dissent is sort of punished or at least polarized. And so we start to identify those kinds of commonly shared factors, and those become kind of an outline of the kind of culture that we would like to look for when we take jobs. They also become the kind of culture that we'd like to create when we're in a leadership position. But the other thing that happens is that some people will identify enablers and disablers that are unique to them. So, for example, I'm an introvert, and so certain kinds of group settings are more difficult for me to act on my values. I'm more comfortable one-on-one. Some people are more comfortable in the debate setting. Some people are more comfortable if they phrase the conversation as a questioning and a learning kind of exchange. And so what that does is it helps us understand that there are certain capacities that each of us have that can make it easier or harder for us. And so one of the tenets of Giving Voice to Values is that everyone can do this, but you do it in different ways, and you should play to your strengths. So if, for example, you're much more comfortable in one-on-one conversations than in group settings, well, then you may frame it that way. If you're more comfortable in writing than in speaking, then you might write a memo, or you might at least write a memo first before you have the conversation so that you're more comfortable with it. If you are somebody who enjoys a good debate, then you may frame it that way, but you might want to work on a dialogue where it's less confrontational. So in other words, this exercise has many pieces in it that we can draw on, both in terms of defining culture, in terms of defining our own personal strengths that we want to play up to, and as I said initially, just establishing from the get-go that this is about helping all of us who would like to be able to better act on our values rather than sorting out, the ethical from the unethical.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about this, Mary, is that you're really talking about a kind of research that you've done with many people over time, and the research is about listening to people's stories and identifying the patterns in those stories.
Exactly.
Yeah. So I want to I want to sort of change course a little bit and ask you about today. Giving voice to values is something that is a program that you're doing out of Babson and with some connection, I guess, to Aspen, and you're also doing as a consultant, and you're going to places all over the world. Can you give us a little bit of a sketch of an idea of the kinds of organizations and the countries that you're working to implement this program in these days?
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, I should clarify that Giving Voice to Values was created with venture funding, if you will, from the Aspen Institute and the Yale School of Management. They're what we call founding partners, and Aspen was kind of the incubator. And then Babson College has been supporting it for the last 6 years. But the program itself exists online. As you said earlier, it's free. People can just download the materials. The only thing that isn't free is if you want to buy the books or the online modules, because those are produced by companies. But basically, you don't need to do that. It's all accessible. And so, you know, my initial goal was to share this with business schools, because that's where I spent most of my professional career. I thought it might be a way to change the way MBA programs, graduate business programs, teach about values and ethics. And what's happened in the last, I don't know, about 8 or 9 years, is that it is in fact being used in hundreds and hundreds of business schools, but it's also being used by companies themselves. I never actually marketed it to companies, but about 7 years ago, Lockheed Martin, the multinational defense contractor, approached me. They'd heard about it and wanted to experiment with it. And that just led to many other companies starting to use this. Corporations are attracted to it because they had the same challenge that I described earlier that business schools did. They were presenting ethics as if it was, we're just going to present the rules to our employees, and we're going to give them some scenarios to make sure they understand whether something is over the line or not. But then they would just stop there, and employees would kind of be cynical and roll their eyes, because many of them would feel that it was not sincere, you know, because they knew that, you know, here they are telling us what the rules are, but tomorrow I'll go to work and my boss or my customer or my coworker is going to pressure me to do something else, and it'll be kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, just do it. And so when we start focusing instead, when we start being honest about that and focusing instead on how could you get this done if you have a customer pressuring you, or even if you have a boss who's pressuring you? How could you raise these issues in a way that would be effective? People started to take it more seriously. They started to feel like this has some integrity. This is the company actually trying to help me behave in the way that they're telling me to behave. Instead of a preach and then pretend that it's possible, they're really trying to enable me. And the employees would also feel that, you know, these were skills that would help them in any kind of management. In fact, some of the companies that were starting to use this would say, really, this is leadership development. You know, it's about being able to communicate any kind of challenging messages. So sometimes corporations come to me, you know, from their ethics and compliance group. And sometimes, as I've been working with McKinsey, the consulting firm, they came to me out of their leadership and learning group. So, you know, it varies in that way. But to answer your question, it's being used on all 7 continents now. It's being used, we don't know how many, because it's all downloadable for free, but I do keep track of anyone who writes to me and says they're using it. And at this point, that's over 850 schools or businesses or other organizations. We've started to work with the military. I did a program at the Pentagon last spring, and based on that, I've been doing some work with the Army. They're trying to build some GVV into their professionalism and ethics training for the 1.2 enlisted and civilian military personnel. I'm doing some work with SHARP, which is the Army's Sexual Harassment and Assault Resources and Prevention Group. I've done some work with the Coast Guard and with the Air Force Academy, and so that's been interesting. I've done work with the police force of Australia and the state of Queensland. They've developed a training program for the police force around, you know, when they deal with ethical issues, which often have to do with how you treat citizens, civilians, you know, how can you raise issues effectively? How can you speak up if your partner or someone else in the force is doing something that's inappropriate? You know, we always hear about the thin blue line and the sense of loyalty within the police force, which may prevent people from raising issues that are important to raise. And so they use GVV in that way. There are educators in other professions now who are starting to use the approach. I'm starting to work with law schools and schools of nursing. I'm co-teaching a course at a college of engineering this semester where we've invited a group of students. We call it Designing the 21st Century Engineer. And we've invited a group of students who are all engineering majors to work with us to co-create a GVV-inspired engineering curriculum. So it's really being adapted in many different ways. We also have some secondary schools that are looking at ways to use it with younger students. We've worked with some sports venues. I do trainings for most of what I do is sort of train the trainer, you know, where I'll present the approach to faculty or corporate trainers or consultants so that they can apply it. So I don't know, that's a beginning of a taste of where it's going.
That's amazing, the scope of that. You know, I'm struck with what you said about the fact that the intellectual property is available on a kind of open source basis where it's there for anybody who wants it. It seems to me you've got a very interesting model going here. It's kind of a hybrid of gift economy and it's the gift economy piece which seems making it so widely used right now.
Yeah, it's interesting you point that out. This was a big thing for me in the beginning, was how to structure this. And I was getting lots of different advice from different people. Fortunately, some of my early supporters, Yale and Aspen, were supportive of the idea of my making it available, at least in a pilot phase, for free. And that was really, you know, I give them a lot of credit for having that generous spirit and insight. There were other folks, though, particularly when I would go to corporate settings. I remember presenting this once at a major aviation organization, and the executive who invited me pulled me aside after my presentation and said, "You know, you could make a mint off of this." I know. And she said, "I don't know why you're giving it away." You know. So, you know, I had different people giving me different advice. Other people were saying you really should have some sort of certification to ensure quality control, you know, that people can't use this unless you have, you know, personally given them an imprimatur, a kind of certification that they are equipped to do this. And so, and I, you know, I thought about all of these approaches. I have a good friend who's a senior partner with IDEO, the innovation consulting firm, and I talked to him about, you know, how do you get ideas to catch on? And, you know, in the end I decided you have to be really clear about your purpose. And my purpose here was not to create a business. It was not to create a consulting firm. My purpose was to transform, it sounds a little immodest, but to transform business education and the way we prepared people for values-driven leadership. And then after a few years, my purpose expanded to sort of be more about transforming the conversation about values more broadly, not just in business school. And so if you think about your purpose that way, then what giving voice to values is it's just an idea. And in fact, it's kind of a simple idea. But I think its simplicity is, you know, why it's powerful and why it catches on. And it seemed to me no one owns ideas, and they're going to be used more widely if you put them out there. I think probably coming out of academia helped because, you know, in academia you sort of measure your impact by how many people use your work. And so all of those things came together, and, you know, I made the decision to make it available for free in the way I have. And, you know, it's worked out really well. It's one of those things, you know, give and take. If you put things out there, you get a return anyways, you know, because, you know, people, I mean, I make a fine living. People will, you know, pay me to come and share and present and advise them. But I don't want to, I always say to people, I never let money get in the way of sharing GVV because I never want that to restrict its impact.
Beautiful. You are modeling giving voice to your values on so many levels, Mary.
You know, but it's interesting you say it that way too, though, Arye, because I don't experience that way. To me, the fact of making it available for free, to be honest with you, did not come out of some higher value. It came out of my sense that I wasn't sure if it would be useful for people. And I thought if I put it out there claiming it's useful for people without being sure, number one, that didn't feel honest, but also I think you trigger resistance. You know, people are going to be skeptical. And instead, if you say, look, I have this idea. I think it's a good idea. Will you come partner with me? And, you know, will you play with me? Will you experiment with me? And to together, we'll see if it can be useful. I mean, that's the way the first company that came to me, I mentioned, was Lockheed Martin, and that's the way I put it to them. I said, look, I don't know if this will work in a corporate setting, but if you are intrigued, let's play together and see, you know. And I did the same thing with faculty in business schools. I said, look, will you pilot this, you know, and let me know if it worked or if it didn't work, and maybe we can make it better. And the good news about that is that then faculty get engaged in contributing to it and creating more materials and making it better and sharing those themselves. So it ends up being this kind of nice cycle.
You've written, and we've spoken a bit about how you've worked with organizations in different countries, in different cultures, and also quite a few times you've been in India.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious about how this process plays out in different cultures. Compared to the U.S., it may be one thing to stand up in an American corporation here in the U.S. and say, well, here's what I believe. It might be something very different to do that in a different culture. Can you say a little bit, say, about how that's different, say, in India compared to the U.S.?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. You had asked that before, and I went off on a different tangent. Yeah, it's really been an interesting journey for me because when I first started sharing Giving Voice to Values, I started getting invited to other parts of the world. India, in fact, was one of the first, and I've been there now, I guess, 9 or 10 times, and have had really great experiences there. There's a whole network of Indian business school faculty who've created India-specific GVV cases. I started working last spring in Egypt, and there's a group of faculty now who are creating Egypt-specific cases. We've done work in China. There's some folks who are working on some China GVV cases, done a lot of work in Australia. I'm working actually in Nigeria now with Unilever, and I was there last fall, and I'll be going back in February to launch a pilot program for all of Unilever, but we're starting with Nigeria around applying GVV. I did a program in Cape Town last December working with a group of business school faculty from across Africa. So there's been a lot of interest across the world. I just got back from Costa Rica. But I learned a few things, and actually I think the best lesson came from one of my early trips to India. When I first created this, a number of faculty in the U.S. and in Western Europe said to me, Mary, this is kind of interesting, and maybe it'll work here, but it's not going to work in a lot of other parts of the world. And I thought, well, they may be right, you know, I don't know. But I was getting invited to those places, so I thought, well, I'll go experiment. So what I learned, and I'll tell you a little story because I think it illustrates it. A few years ago, I was invited to go to do a 2-day program in Bangalore and to repeat it in Delhi. And the program was for business school faculty in India who teach entrepreneurship as well as Indian entrepreneurs. And it was to introduce them to Giving Voice to Values. And so in each of those two cities, that the beginning of the first of the 2 days, there would be like 35 people sitting in the room, and they would be sort of leaning back in their chairs with their arms folded across their chests with these kinds of skeptical looks on their faces. And I remember I was trying to get started, and I was, could read their body language, you know, and I said, what's wrong? You know, what's going on? And, you know, nobody would say anything, but eventually some brave soul would say, well, madam, we're delighted you're here, and we're very happy to listen to you for 2 days. But you have to understand, this is India, and we are entrepreneurs. And we can't even get driver's licenses without paying bribes. So this is not really going to be relevant to us. But we're happy to listen to you. And so I thought, okay, now what do I do? So what I said, you know, I found out there were basically 5 steps I had to take. The first step was I had to acknowledge the reality of the context. And this is not unique to India. I've had this experience in China and in other parts in Africa. So the first thing you do is you acknowledge the reality of the context. So in that situation, I said, look, I know what you're saying is true. This is my, you know, 7th or 8th visit at that point to India. I've experienced it myself, you know, not to get a driver's license, but in other circumstances. So you have to acknowledge the reality and not pretend. Otherwise, you're just not being respectful. The second thing you have to do is I had to say, look, this is not about me, Mary Gentile, coming from Boston to tell you what your values should be in Delhi. This is me coming and saying, I know you have values, and I know that it's often difficult to act on them. And so this is about seeing if we can work together to try and find some ways to make it easier. So you have to start from that position of respect, where you're not preaching values, but you are playing to the values that are already there. And then the third thing you do is you acknowledge, or I explain the giving voice to values thought experiment, which I think I may have already briefly mentioned on this call, but it's the idea that I'm not going to put you on the spot and say, what would you do in this situation? Instead, I'm going to say, what if you wanted to act according to these values in this situation? How could you get it done? And so that kind of relieves people's stress and pressure and lets them relax and be a little bit more constructive and problem-solving. The fourth thing I try and do when I go into other cultures is I always try and have an example of someone who did effectively voice and act on their values from that culture. So in the case of this visit to India, I happened to have a video that I developed in collaboration with the Carnegie Council in New York, where we had interviewed an Indian entrepreneur who had purchased a company from a major multinational. And when they purchased the company, it was based in India, but they sold their product in the West. It was hugely corrupt, and it was basically bankrupt. And in the space of 2 years, this Indian entrepreneur took this company and transformed it. It became financially quite successful, and it also became a model of clean operations. And so we had a video interview with him where he basically gave example after example of how he did this. And he did it in very small, tactical ways. It wasn't some big preaching. It was more what makes it hard for these employees to be able to act in non-corrupt ways in the setting they're in? What's the reality of the pressures they're under? And then he came up with strategies that enabled their behavior. And you know, I can share some examples if you're interested. So I shared that with these Indian faculty and entrepreneurs, and so that did two things. On the one hand, it appealed to a sense of pride. You know, here's someone from my own culture who has done something really impressive here. And number two, it appealed to their sense of competition. So it was kind of like, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And then the fifth and last thing that I find I have to do when I go into other cultures that I have to make it clear to people that the voice in giving voice to values is a metaphor. So it doesn't mean that you're going to go to your boss and stamp your foot and shake your fist and tell your boss that he or she is wrong and unethical. In fact, that doesn't even work in the West. But you're going to develop a strategy and an approach that will be that will play to your own strengths and that will be appropriate in the context that you're operating in. And I find that it's particularly important to name that when I'm in some cultures like China, for example, that are very sort of, you know, high there's a real authoritarian or cultural differential about what's appropriate in terms of communicating to people who are at different places in the hierarchy. So explaining to them that that's a metaphor becomes important. But those five things, I've found when I do those, people kind of get engaged in it, you know, because they're like, yeah, you know, it really bothered me that, you know, I felt this pressure, and it would be interesting to see if there would be any other alternative. I mean, a lot of times people are kind of beaten down, and they sort of feel like you just can't do anything else in this culture. But when you frame it as a thought experiment and say, yeah, but, you know, just for the sake of this exercise, let's just think about what if you wanted to, what could you do? It just shifts people's energy, and I've found that to be a real useful approach.
So were you able to turn around the mood in that
room? Yeah, it was really interesting. By the end of the 2 days, people got really engaged, and they were when they got to the point where they were actually, you know, working on problem solving and creating scripts and action plans for the cases, they got so excited they were kind of slipping into Hindi. And so I had fortunately invited a good friend of mine from Goa to co-teach with me. So she was like whispering in my ear, translating what they were saying, you know, but they did. They got very engaged, and it ended up being, you know, something that felt much more practical to them.
Wow. So we've just got a few more minutes left, and then I'm going to turn it back over to Nicole, who can field people's questions. But I've been curious about sort of the bigger question that for me is really in all of that, and that is, will empowering people in all of these places and all of these organizations to give voice to their values result in a better world? And, you know, I'm thinking specifically, what about people that have values that you and I and most people on this call would disagree with? What about, say, the values we think about certain people on Wall Street, the whole greed is good values, and it's important, and I value measuring my success by the amount of money I've made, regardless of what I had to do to make it? Or what about the kinds of values of people who say my tribe, my religion, my race, whatever is the best, and everybody should be subservient? How does giving voice to values play in a world where there are lots of people that have those kinds of values?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, when I talk about GVV to people, I always talk about how, for me, it grew out of a crisis of faith where I began to feel that, you know, maybe trying to act on, maybe trying to teach about ethics was in business schools was unethical because it felt a little hypocritical at worst and, you know, or at least futile. And so because I'm the kind of person who worries about that sort of thing, I'm kind of earnest. When I first started creating Giving Voice to Values, I literally would lay awake at night thinking, gee, is this going to teach people to voice bad values, you know, more effectively? And I wondered about that, you know. And what I ended up concluding was that with the application that I was focused on, which at that point was business schools, that the prevailing conversation was basically the one that you just presented, you know, the kind of Wall Street, you know, maximize shareholder value at all expenses, externalize any kind of cost to the environment and place those on society rather than internalizing them to the firm, you know, greed is good, et cetera, et cetera. And it seemed to me that that was kind of the prevailing conversation. The prevailing conversation was, if you want me to be ethical, first you have to prove to me that that can be financially successful, that being good pays. And so it struck me that that conversation was already out there. And when you think about our own lives, you know, I mean, from childhood on, we know how to rationalize it when we do something that's naughty, right? You know, you do something and your parents catch you and you've always got excuses, you know. And it struck me that that conversation's already out there, and we're very well practiced at that already. And that what we need to do is to create consciously constructed, carefully deliberated process for practicing and rehearsing the other voice. And I don't mean just, oh, it's the right thing to do. I mean, how do you get the right thing done? So when you get to those questions about, you know, conflicts of religion and ideology, you know, it's kind of a shouting match. This is right. No, this is right. That's not voicing your values in the way GVV intends it. GVV is really about thinking through, and we have a protocol for this in the curriculum where you think through what's at risk or at stake for all the parties. You think through what the typical rationalizations and objections you might hear would be. You think through how you might reframe that. You think through the strategy you need to use in terms of, you know, building a coalition or, you know, identifying allies or identifying an incremental sequence of events or gathering data. So it struck me that wasn't out there, and that in a business school environment, and certainly in a lot of businesses, the way you show you're smart and the way you show you're sophisticated is by voicing the most skeptical or even cynical perspective when it comes to values. And so what we were doing with GVV was creating the mandate kind of cover for people to show they're smart by figuring out how to do the thing that everyone says it's impossible to do. So now when you say, you know, how would you voice your values in this situation, you know, people don't have to feel like they're goody two-shoes or naive or Pollyanna to be putting forward an ethically motivated action plan, because we've actually assigned them that task. And so now they're applying that ability to that. And so that kind of reassured me on the sort of voicing bad values front. I felt like, well, it's kind of already out there. But then there were a couple other things, which one was, typically in ethics classes, certainly in business schools, but not just in business schools, in ethics classes, people will often assume it's not really necessary to have a discussion about the so-called clear-cut, so-called black-and-white, right-wrong kinds of issues, that those are pretty easy, and we really should focus on, you know, what people tend to call the gray issues, the ethical dilemmas. And, you know, I used to think that was the right approach, too. But I've changed my mind, because I think that a lot of those gray issues, those ethical dilemmas, are situations where reasonable people of goodwill and intelligence can legitimately disagree. That's why they're gray. And that, nevertheless, there are a lot of issues where most of us, not everyone, but most of us would agree that that's clearly over the line. That's clearly a bad idea. But just because we agreed, it doesn't mean that we think it's possible to do it. And so what I decided to do with the GVV curriculum is to share scenarios where the protagonist, the actor in the case study, has already decided what he or she thinks is right. And it tends to be a less controversial position, but it's still very difficult to act on it. And so people are required to rehearse and practice how do you get the right thing done in those circumstances. And then, you know, in terms of some ideological differences, it kind of reminds me of the experience I had back when I was teaching that diversity class at Harvard. I remember one day I decided I was going to teach a class about affirmative action. And at a place like Harvard Business School back in the mid-90s, that was one of the most controversial topics I could have brought up in that class, because this is a group of people who are, you know, were very much motivated by a kind of traditional profit-oriented meritocracy-focused kind of traditional capitalist perspective for their careers. And the idea of affirmative action to them seemed like it was you know, maybe in contradiction to that. And so I remember I had a case study, and I couldn't get anyone to talk, you know, because they knew that it was a controversial issue, and they suspected that I had an agenda, and, you know, they just weren't going to play. And, you know, it's a pretty rare thing at a place like Harvard Business School to have no one willing to speak. And so finally I just said, look, let's just put the case aside, and I'm going to ask you to engage in an experiment. And I drew a line down the middle of a blackboard, and I said, okay, here on this side of the board, for one, you know, for a few minutes, I want all of you in the class to pretend that you are vehement opponents of affirmative action. And tell me, what are the values that drive you to be against affirmative action? And so they gave me a list of values, and they were things like meritocracy and fairness and justice and things like that. And then I said, okay, now let's go to the other side of the board, and I want all of you for a few minutes to pretend that you are vehemently in support of affirmative action. What are the values that drive your position? And of course, they generated the same list of values. And so what I said is, look, this does not solve the issue. But the point is here that this is not a values conflict. This is now an implementation problem. We may have legitimate reasons why we think affirmative action is a good or bad, an effective or less effective way of reaching these values, but we're not arguing about the values. And I think that that experience really informed me with GVV as well, because I realized that, you know, you don't have to have people agree about everything in order to work well in an organization and in order to serve certain important, widely shared sort of core human values. I would always say to people in the diversity class, look, you know, there's a lot of things we're going to always disagree on, but there's certain values that we all want because they serve all of us. So if you're working in the same organization, you know, someone might be, you know, vehemently anti-abortion, and someone might be, you know, vehemently pro-choice. But the fact is that they don't have to convince each other in order to work with each other. In order to work with each other, they do have to act respectfully toward each other because they have the shared goal of wanting the organization to thrive. That's in both their interests.
So thank you,
and
Mary.
So that's the kind of way I would reframe those challenges. It's tricky, but I do think it's an important question to raise and deal with.
Now, what I get from listening to you is that you're really what you're doing with this program and your intent is to create sort of more bandwidth for people to talk about the real values that the real human values that people have.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. So look, I'd like to turn this over to Nicole so we can give other people on the call a chance to connect with you.
Great. Absolutely. And thank you for all your questions, Arye.
Thank you.
I just that last piece that you were talking about, what I really heard was developing the practice of compassion and empathy in conversation. And that, you're blowing my mind in a wonderful way.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. In business schools, I don't always use the same language
because
it's a kind of cultural thing. But now there's so much research about empathy that it's becoming, you know, easier and easier to even name it that way.
Right. And I come from the education sector. So
it's very appropriate.
Yeah,
and Nicole, one thing I wanted to say to you about your opening story, which I love.
Yeah.
That when I created GVV, my idea was that this was about enabling people to voice their values negatively, that is, to say no to unethical behaviors, fraud or deception or whatever, abuse. But as people have begun to use GVV, they've begun to adapt it, and it's also a methodology that can help people voice their values affirmatively, which is helping a group say yes to positive behaviors. So people are using it to support discussions of sustainability, for example. And I thought your example was a perfect instance of voicing your values affirmatively in your nonprofit board.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to say this clearly because it's still kind of mulling around in my head. It's something that towards the beginning, an edge that I kind of got to was, you know, when I was teaching, I was always told whenever I went to a new school, make friends with the secretary. Your best friends should be the secretary and the janitor. And I'm thinking about these values, and I realized I followed that. I naturally followed that. I made friends with a lot of people, but a lot of times I'd be working in my classroom late at night, and the janitor would come in, and we would have these beautiful conversations about our values. Mm-hmm. And I think both of us kind of felt powerless to jump into practice. A lot of times, but I actually go back to those conversations quite a bit, and just the practice of that conversation allowed me to release some of the angst and the anxiety and the released me from activism, which could have caused a lot more of turbulence, I guess, in a system that was already pretty turbulent. I don't know if I have a question around that, but just maybe if you have any examples or of practices like that that maybe aren't steeped in change, but just steeped in conversation for people at all levels, especially in kind of corporations that are very top down.
Right.
Does that make sense? Try to pull that out. I don't know how much sense I made.
Yeah, let me take a stab at it. If I'm not getting to what you wanted to get at, Nicole, just ask some follow on. But I think what I hear you saying, one of the things I say to people is I wouldn't really want a conversation to release someone from action, but at the same time, there are some situations where action is going to be harder or more challenging or less effective than others. And what I always try and do with students and with other individuals who are interested in GVV is I try and be honest, and I try and say, look, this isn't easy, and it's not even always possible. But nevertheless, it is hugely important, and we can get better at it. And that's what GVV is about, is the rehearsal and the practice to get better at it, and also learning from people who've been successful. And so what I would say is that those kinds of conversations you're talking about, whether they're with the janitor or the secretary or our colleagues, you know, sometimes we're in situations where we haven't yet figured out how to act on our values, or we've tried and we haven't been successful yet. And what I always try and say to people is that the main thing in those situations is to stay in the journey, you know. So you have kind of a couple of choices here. You can say, well, you know, it's just impossible, so I'm going to give up, and I will just, you know, give in and shut up and do what they tell me to do, or maybe even, you know, go to the dark side, you know, and really embrace it. Or you can figure, well, I haven't figured out how to make this change yet, but I'm going to keep on the journey. I'm going to continue to see myself as in process and looking for ways to make change. And maybe that might initially be simply having conversations with people until enough of us have talked about this that we have kind of a group of allies, or until enough of us have talked about this that we've been able to brainstorm some interesting new strategies, or until enough of us have talked about this so that we're ready when the opportunity presents itself. Because, you know, change can't always happen immediately, and especially if you're talking about systemic change. I mean, it's one thing if you have an individual, you are being asked to do something, you know, and it's clearly wrong and you want to say yes or no. But it's another thing when you're in a system where there are some embedded behaviors that are problematic. Those don't change overnight. And sometimes having those conversations is a way to keep yourself in the journey, to keep those issues alive. The challenge is when having those conversations simply becomes a way of releasing steam so that you never have to make change. And I think that that's the sort of it's a subtle distinction, and it's something that we have to be honest with ourselves about, and kind of try and look for the ways that we can make sure that we're still on the journey. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that's, I think your process is such, and you touched on this, is this a flip on the way that is prevalent, the prevalent kind of process.
Yeah.
And I really resonate it because what I hear is it's a mindset of playfulness and experimentation.
Exactly. And, I call it piloting. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and piloting and that mindset to get people to trust that, I've noticed, especially when you're kind of saying, "Hey," in a corporation that traditionally has been top down, it takes a lot of practice and time.
Yeah.
So
absolutely, I think of it as reframing, as
right.
as I like your language of experimentation. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we have a call coming in from Dorsey from Sarasota, Florida. And she says, in light of environmental disaster in Flint, Michigan, is this not a good example of people not knowing how to voice their values and prevent such a disaster?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I definitely would agree. I haven't researched what happened. I mean, I know what happened in Flint, but I haven't researched what people's responses have been. But it does remind me of back when there was the oil spill in the Gulf, the BP oil spill, and the Huffington Post invited me to write an op-ed about, the assumption was I would write an op-ed about why people hadn't voiced their values, and it led to this oil spill. And so I started to do some research, and what I found when I did the research was that, in fact, there had been a lot of people who had spoken up, engineers at BP, employees at Halliburton, public sector employees in the mineral and mining service of the U.S. government. And despite the fact that they had spoken up, nothing changed. And so what I ended up writing the op-ed about was that, just speaking is not enough. We have to actually learn and practice and get better at doing it effectively. If you speak up alone in a systemic challenge, which that was, often it's like popcorn, right? I'll speak up and my boss will ignore me. You'll speak up and your boss will chastise you. Someone else will speak up and they'll feel alone and not supported by their peers. And it's not until we actually think more strategically and tactically about how to raise these issues that we can really make an impact. I always like to tell people, if you're trying to move your organization to do something new, and let's say it doesn't have anything to do with values, maybe it has to do with launching a new product or reaching out to a new market segment or adapting a new institutional software system, something really not all that involved with ethics. But you wouldn't just say, oh, this is the right thing to do. You would, do the research. You would, marshal your arguments. You would identify who's likely to support this and get them lined up to help you make the case, and you would identify who's maybe likely to oppose this, and you would try and reach out to them and address their concerns and kind of neutralize their objections before it became a challenge. You would do all of that, and you just think that's the normal way to get something changed. But when it comes to ethics, we think we're just supposed to, blow the whistle or speak out. And, I think that's misguided. I think we should approach these issues just like any other challenge and use all those skills that we have. So in answer to the question about Flint, Michigan, my guess is that there may well have been people, as in the BP example, who did speak up, but the challenge is figuring out how to do it in a way that will be effective. And I don't mean to be naive or Pollyanna-ish. I know that often these challenges are very, very difficult, and that, I think, is why it becomes even more important to, learn how people have been able to communicate these issues effectively in the past.
Right. Something just came to my mind, too, I struggle with this on a daily basis, thinking about some of the more recent technological tools like Facebook. I see a lot of people use that as a tool to express and value, but I think that it gets confused with that is their action, that is their practice.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point. I love that. That's their action, and also that it's not really, it's venting more than problem solving. You know what I mean? It's not.
Right.
It's not really. Was it you or Arye who talked about empathy and compassion? You know, it's not really trying to see things from different perspectives and think about how do we frame this issue in a way that it'll work for everyone. It's really just, you know, you're bad, I'm good. And now I'm virtuous because I said it.
right. It kind of lets them off the hook.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm going to just remind callers that you can press *6 to jump into the conversation. And then also, if you have a question or a comment, you can do ask@servicebase.org. And I'm going to bring Wendy into the conversation. Are you there, Wendy?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Thank you so much for the conversation so far. Okay, I'm holding it here. Okay, so I have a question for Mary, and I was very interested to hear that you'd been working with nursing schools, and I recently retired as a nurse practitioner. And in my last few years, I became quite aware of how corporate health care has been becoming. And so sometimes there seems to be a collision of values of people who went into health care in terms of taking care of patients in certain ways, yet there's also a collision with the values of the corporation. I had worked for a very large health care organization. So there was a collision with the business values and the number values. And so I recently read a statistic which said that over half of physicians are now experiencing burnout, and certainly we know that there's a large turnover for nurses. So I'm wondering how you work in healthcare settings when there does seem to be this dichotomy of what the corporation is wanting and also the values of the workers, the healthcare workers.
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and I think it's not unique to nursing or medicine. I mean, I think that most of the values conflicts that I encounter in other professions, whether it's law, whether it's engineering, and in business too, are times when, you know, some of the economic organizational pressures conflict with other objectives, whether it's serving customers well, whether it's seeking justice if you're in the legal profession, whether it's designing a building in engineering or whatever. So it's a great question. There's a few things I would suggest or I would mention that we're doing in that arena. One thing I'll say just at the beginning so I don't forget is that there are some faculty actually in Australia who've been using GVV in their nursing education now for several years and have even published an article about their experiences using GVV in nursing education. And so if it's something particularly of interest to you, Wendy, you should feel free to contact me, and I will send you that article and even put you in touch with those nursing educators if that's of interest to you. I've seen this pressure that you've talked about. I guess the example I'll give is not a nursing example, but I think it translates. I did some work with a group of public sector executives in the state of Queensland in Australia a few years ago. They were CEOs of statutory organizations. So these are the organizations that serve the public good. So maybe they were, health and welfare organizations or child welfare organizations or other kinds of issues like that. And so they were experts in their fields and they ran these organizations, and their mission was in fact to serve the public good around the issue that they were concerned with. And I see that as similar to, nurses and physicians who are trying to address the well-being of their patients. But at the same time, their bosses, if you will, the people to whom they reported, were publicly elected officials. So what would sometimes happen is that individuals would be elected to hold, you know, political positions, who were more interested in getting these CEOs to run their organization in a way that they thought would make it easier for them to get reelected, even if it wasn't the thing that was in the best interests from the more informed perspective of the individuals who ran those organizations. And so it is a similar kind of conflict between, you know, your organizational success and the well-being of your patient or your consumer or the citizens. And so when I worked with them, we generated a number of scenarios that that premised this kind of conflict. And we introduced the GVV methodology to them. And then, you know, I don't have the solutions to these situations, but what I did is I asked them a different question. So I didn't ask them, you know, is the publicly elected official right or are you right? I said, you know, what if you wanted to behave in the way that you believe is in the best service of the population you serve and your and the official who you report to is telling you to do something different? How could you resolve that conflict? And when you frame the question that way, rather than as an ethical issue, they all got, I mean, they were very clever, and they all got very good at thinking about ways to reframe the problem so the official would actually see that there was an opportunity for him or her to get an upside in it as well and to, you know, communicate in different ways. And what we basically did is tapped into the very skills that got them elected or got them promoted to their CEO positions in the first place. And they began to realize that, you know, when they framed it as an ethics issue, it became this no win. It reminds me of a conversation I had recently with a friend of mine who's a physician who's been working with a network of hospitals here in the Boston area, and they've been trying to figure out ways to put a new system for evaluating and compensating for medical care into place. And it's I'm sure you're familiar with it as a health professional, but it's an outcome-oriented charging and reimbursement process. And it's been used for patients, but it hasn't really been applied to low-income individuals who are on government subsidy for their health care. And so the belief was that that wouldn't be cost-effective. And so he's been working for a number of years now to do the research and to do the piloting in order to be able to make a case that, in fact, this could be managed in a way that would be both better for the patients, as it obviously is because it's outcome-oriented, but also could be financially viable. And it's taken a lot of reframing. It's taken a lot of careful research. It's taken a lot of new communication messages around the time frame and how you structure the reimbursement. But I see it as very much a GVV exercise. And he wasn't presenting it as just this is the ethical thing to do, although, of course, that's what's driving him. He was presenting it as this is something that is both right for the patients and, in fact, we can find a way to structure it so that it will enable the organizations to continue to thrive. So I do think that it's applicable in those circumstances, but you need to reframe it as it's not just about being good. It's about being pragmatic, too. It's about being competent. I always tell people GVV is less about moral courage than it is about moral competence.
That's a good way of framing it. Thank you so much.
Sure.
It makes me go back to kind of something you said of how you your process of actually launching this, of just kind of saying, I have this idea, you know, will you come and experiment with me?
Exactly.
And then, you know, and believing in an idea not as ownership. I think you also mentioned that too. Like, no, we don't own our idea. Or, you know, no one individual owns an idea.
Exactly.
Once it's out, it's out there. I'm going to have RA come back in for one final question. unless somebody wants to jump in from the call. I think we're good, though. So,
okay.
Right, do you want to jump in?
Yeah. So, Mary, you know, I'm in listening to you, I'm circling back to something you had told me earlier before the call, that your PhD is in literature and film.
Yeah.
And, you know, the question, we just have a few minutes, but, you know, contemplating this question of how you get from a PhD in literature and film to working at Harvard Business Graduate School of Business. You know, so the question comes to me specifically was, you know, in your process of going from point A to point B, was there a point in your journey where you had to make your own personal decision about giving voice to your values? And what effect did that have?
That's a great question. That's a great question. Well, the short answer is yes. And I think, you know, actually it probably happened in multiple occasions. You know, there were times when, I'm not sure, we may have talked about this, there were times when I've had, you know, choices. I remember Harvard, you know, offered me basically, you know, you can stay here and just have an ongoing career and, you know, and solve the problems we want you to solve, which were good problems. I mean, there was nothing unethical about it. Or you can work on the issues that matter to you, and we'll keep you around for 2 years to do that, but then you'll have to go, you know. And, you know, I chose the latter option, which, you know, some people thought was crazy, you know, to give up the option of continued employment at Harvard Business School for, you know, the great unknown. But it seemed to me that I really wanted to focus on the things that mattered to me rather than just using my talents in the service of somebody else's goals, you know. So those things happened for me. I think the other thing is the reason I wanted to do GVV and also do the managing diversity class were because I always saw myself as an introvert and a risk-averse kind of person. And I felt like I was also the kind of person who recognized things that I thought were inequitable or wrong, but I felt like I was too chicken to do anything about it. You know, it was just not I was not a confrontational person. And I wanted to develop these approaches because I wanted to figure out, is there a way for someone like me to be effective? And, you know, so I was finding out that actually there are many ways to act and voice on your values. And they're not all about, you know, being an aggressive and extroverted person, although those people can do it too. But they will do it in different ways. And so I was solving my own problem. And I guess the last thing I'll say about it is that having a PhD in literature and film means I was acutely aware of the power of story. And I think you were talking about that earlier, Arye. And I was acutely aware of the power of narrative. And I think when I look at giving voice to values, it's at looking at any particular values challenge that that one of us may have, whether it's in business or nursing or government or in our families, and looking at the same set of circumstances and the same set of facts, but being able to craft a different story about what might be possible in that situation. And I think if you study narrative, if you study literature and film, you understand both the power of story and also the power you have to create story, to create narrative, to recraft, to reframe. And so I actually don't think I ever would have thought of GVV if I'd come up straight up through, you know, economics or business or law. I think it was the fact of coming from another discipline and then bringing it to the business realm is what enabled me to do that.
Wonderful tie-in. And
yeah.
The rest is history.
Oh, wow. I really enjoy that. So we have one final question for you.
Okay.
And that would be, how can we, as the larger service-based community, support your work?
Oh, God, thank you for asking that. Well, so anyone who's interested and curious can just go to our website. The easiest website to go to is just givingvoicetovaluesthebook.com. You can also just go to marygentile.com, and it'll take you to the same page. And you'll find all the information. You'll find the book. You'll find lots of articles, interviews. You'll find the curriculum itself. And you'll also, you can contact me directly, just mary@marygentile.com. And, you know, to share with people how they can use the approach in their own organizations. If anyone wants to develop workshops or to teach with the approach, I'll be happy to be helpful for them. And, you know, happy to just have conversations about how we can take this work further.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I'm sure some stories will come out of that. And we'll also include the link in our follow-up email.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. So thank you so much. I just, from so many examples, I think it's wonderful to hear of all of the various types of organizations and industries that your work has gone into. And I think for me personally, just really hearing about your process, your personal process in coming to this work, and then how you infuse that into it coming out into the world has been a wonderful example for my own work.
Oh, thank you.
So I wanted to thank you for that, and thank you for the stories, and I wanted to thank the audience. And as we do with every call, we hold another moment of silence in gratitude, and then after we come out of that moment of silence, we're going to open up the lines and do a thank you. So we'll have that moment of silence now.